Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, July 27th, 2018 edition of the News Gazette. And we'll begin on the front page with a piece from the U.S. District Court ruling called Judge Sides with UI in Student's Dismissal, but he urges campus to change how sex assault claims handled, by Ben Zigerman Urbana. While a former University of Illinois student accused of sexual assault lost his lawsuit this week against the university, a federal judge urged the UI to change how it investigates sexual assault claims. U.S. District Court Judge Colin Bruce ruled narrowly in favor of the UI, concluding that John Doe wasn't entitled to due process in the case because he didn't prove that he suffered a tangible loss after being dismissed from the UI for 2.5 years. Mere defamation by the government does not deprive a person of a liberty interest protected by the 14th Amendment, even when it causes serious impairment of one's future employment, Bruce wrote, later writing that Doe failed to show he has a legally protected entitlement to his continued education at the university. Doe failed to identify a property interest at stake, and thus there is no need for the court to proceed, Bruce wrote. We expect to appeal, said Doe's lawyer in Chicago, Mark Roth. While not ruling on the legality of the UI's process, Bruce still stated his grave concern and serious doubts over the constitutionality of the UI's sexual misconduct investigation and adjudication process. To comport with due process, expulsion procedures must provide a student with a meaningful opportunity to be heard, Bruce wrote. The UI's process falsely emulates a criminal inquiry, but lacks the ability of the accused to confront witnesses, be heard, or testify before the deciding panel, he wrote. While Bruce said that this case is not the appropriate vehicle to address the propriety of defendants' investigatory process, he urged the UI to adopt a more fair and thorough procedure for handling sexual assault claims in the future. University spokeswoman Robin Kaler declined to comment on whether the decision could lead to changes, saying, "We are reviewing the court's decision." Roe could not consent. Doe, a sophomore at the time of the incident, allegedly sexually assaulted Jane Roe, then a senior, in the early morning hours of December 4, 2016. And both Doe and Jane Roe are in quotation marks. After an investigation, he was dismissed in April 2017, with a review panel concluding that he convinced Roe's friend that he could take Roe home, took her instead back to his apartment, and had sex with her. Roe told investigators that she repeatedly told Doe no and that she does not do hookups. "You met the complainant and her friend at a local bar. The complainant had already been drinking when she met up with you, and she continued to drink in your presence," the panel said, later concluding, "The complainant was incapacitated at the time of the sexual activity, and so could not consent." Doe can petition to return to the UI in spring 2019. In his lawsuit, in addition to arguing that the sex was consensual, Doe took issue with the UI's process for investigating sexual assaults, arguing that he was only interviewed once, several weeks after the alleged assault, wasn't allowed to review the final investigative report, and wasn't allowed to attend a hearing to present his side of the case and cross-examine witnesses. In the UI's process, an investigator reviews both parties who can give supporting information and identify witnesses. The investigator then compiles a report that both parties can review and submit a response to. Then the investigator compiles a revised report which both parties can also submit responses to. The final investigative report is then submitted to a 3-person panel, which meets with and questions the investigator. The panel then makes a decision by a simple majority vote using the preponderance of the evidence standard proof. Bruce said having the investigator present to the panel about the credibility of the people involved is a poor substitute for allowing an accused to appear in person and defend themselves. While the UI doesn't need to implement a full-blown criminal trial with counsel, the right to cross-examine witnesses, or the reasonable doubt standard, he said, that at the very minimum, an accused party should be able to present his or her case to the person or people who actually decide their fate. This due process lawsuit is one of several filed since 2011, when the U.S. Education Department issued its Dear Colleague letter that said colleges should use a preponderance of the evidence standard. Last year, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos rescinded the letter, allowing colleges to use the higher clear and convincing evidence standard. Doe, no tangible loss. In Doe's case against the UI, Bruce decided against him, arguing that Doe didn't show he had a liberty or property interest that would be protected by the Constitution's 14th Amendment, which says that no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. If Doe could prove that he suffered a tangible loss of other employment opportunities as a result of the UI publicly disclosing his discipline, Bruce said he could argue he had a liberty interest in this case. But Doe cannot show that defendant ever publicly disclosed his disciplinary record, and, even more importantly, he admits that he never actually completed and submitted an application to any other school, and that said school rejected him because of his disciplinary record, Bruce wrote. And to show a property interest, Bruce said Doe would need to show that there was an express or implied contract with the school, since the Seventh Circuit has rejected the proposition that an individual has a standalone property interest in an education at a state university. While Doe argued that there was an implied contract based on language in the student code, Bruce concluded there wasn't because Doe hadn't read the student code before being admitted to the UI. If Doe was completely unaware and did not read any portion of the student code or the procedures, he cannot claim they were communicated to him by the university, Bruce wrote. To avoid this confusion in the future, Bruce encouraged the UI to provide a means for the incoming student to indicate they have read and understood the student code, such as a signed acknowledgement to be returned with the student's acceptance of admission. And next from the University of Illinois, NCSA not picked for latest NSF project. $60 million supercomputer going to Texas instead, by Julie Wirth Urbana. The National Science Foundation's newest supercomputer will go to Texas, not the University of Illinois. The National Science Board voted this week to award the project to the Advanced Computing Center at the University of Texas at Austin, according to the agency's website. The $60 million project is much smaller than the Blue Water supercomputer at the UI's National Center for Supercomputing Applications, said NCSA Director William Gropp. Blue Waters is a leadership class system, originally funded with $208 million from NSF, plus $150 million for 5 years of operations, not counting $60 million from the state, he said. Gropp and others were expecting a similar size project this time, but NSF opted to go smaller, he said. Illinois submitted a competitive proposal that won positive reviews, but the school learned this week that it would not be coming to NCSA, he said. Gropp said, "It's a real blow to the people who worked so hard on it. But NCSA has four other supercomputers besides Blue Waters and two comparable-sized NSF big data projects, with more to come. I'm disappointed. It would have been good to have this machine. But I'm staring at my wall of all the other stuff that we're working on. There are just so many other opportunities, Grop said. We can put energy into working with other agencies, working with campus strategic priorities. The long-term picture for us remains great. The NSF has yet to announce the selection of its rationale, but the National Science Board approved the award this week. Texas is a strong competitor, Grop said, and may have gotten a better deal from a vendor. NSF's total pool of money for the high-performance computing hasn't been growing, he said, with more and more people after it. Blue Waters, which went online in 2013 after years of planning, will continue to be used through spring of 2019, or possibly longer. Like iPhones, supercomputers get better every day, and Blue Waters is getting fairly long in the tooth, he said. Thousands of researchers across the country have used its computing power to study everything from viruses to weather patterns to galaxies and anything you can think of, Grop said. In the last year, he said, one project used stereo images from satellites to create digital elevation maps for the entire Arctic region for the first time, at a much lower cost than sending people out with surveying equipment, he said. Those maps are more accurate, I'm told, than most of the maps of the United States west of the Mississippi, he said. Kristen Williamson, Senior Assistant Director at NCSA, said the UI still has more computing power than any campus in the nation. Blue Waters has been the most advanced scientific computing facility ever built by the NSF, addressing the most demanding grand challenge problems, and it continues to do so, she said. The outcome of this particular new award was never going to define the future of NCSA, Williamson added. Blue Waters is actually a small project relative to NCSA's total size, Grop said. Its four other supercomputers are funded through its Expanding Industry Partners program, he said. The center will also be the data facility for a huge NSF project still under review, he said. NCSA won two huge projects from the NSF within the last 2 years. A five-year, $110 million grant for an extreme science partnership headquartered at the UI that has contributed to such discoveries as HIV's chemical structure and gravitational waves in space. It's known as the Extreme Science and Engineering Discovery Environment, or XSEDE. A grant to serve as the central global hub for the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, an ambitious project to survey one-third of the sky to detect new and unexpected astronomical events. NCSA will process, archive, and serve the terabytes of data that will be collected every night of the decade-long survey. NCSA hopes to partner with other federal agencies on supercomputing projects, Grop said, adding that he hopes to have some news within the year. And the next piece is from the City of Champaign. Proposal on house-to-lot ratio will get hearing. Complaints by group of residents inspired it. By Deborah Pressey, Champaign. Months after Mike Reed and his neighbors began meeting about a home building trend they don't like, they're going to have a chance next week to hear about how the city may be changing the rules. Reed co-founded a group called No Giant Houses, opposed to the construction of behemoth houses on smaller size lots, many of which are in their central Champaign neighborhood surrounding Clark Park. Objectors have contended large new houses being built on small lots in their neighborhood are both dwarfing the older, smaller ones already there and gobbling up too much open space. Reed said he and his neighbors haven't heard anything from the city about their concerns since a January Champaign City Council meeting, so we're anxious to hear what they have to say. Before proposed changes in requirements about house versus lot size are brought back to the council next month, city planning officials plan to present them to the public at a meeting set for 6 to 8 p.m. Monday at the Champaign Public Library. Possible changes have broader implications than how they'd impact a single neighborhood, according to Eric Van Buskirk, an associate city planner. Planners are looking at this issue from a citywide perspective, he said. The planning department has been studying several possible options since January, when the council rejected a proposal that would have allowed a new construction house about 43% larger than is currently allowed to be built on a typical Clark Park size lot. Van Buskirk said the solution planners want to propose to the council is doing away with the current floor area ratio requirement used to calculate how large a house can be built on various lot sizes, replacing it with the more commonly used lot coverage calculation. Floor area ratio factors in the usable square footage of a house and the lot size, while lot coverage is based on the footprint of the building and what percentage of the lot it will cover. The City Council will have the final say on any changes, and the public will have an opportunity to express opinions, both at the Monday meeting and at an August 7th City Council meeting, Van Buskirk said. Thomas O'Rourke, a member of the No Giant Houses Steering Committee, lives blocks away from the Clark Park neighborhood and is also eager to hear more details about possible changes to come. If you're a single-family homeowner and you're on a small lot, you have every incentive to go to the meeting because the decisions will affect you, he said. And next, a piece about a fatal 2017 accident on Interstate 57. Distracted driver gets jail probation. Victim's kin opposed defense request for home detention. By Mary Shank, Urbana. A Mattoon man who admitted his distracted driving on a crowded interstate led to the death of a Camargo girl a year ago has been sentenced to 30 months of probation and 6 months in the county jail. But whether Stephen Cruz, 38, of Mattoon, actually serves the jail portion of his sentence behind bars or in his home has yet to be decided. Cruz pleaded guilty Thursday to aggravated unlawful use of an electronic communication device, a Class 4 felony, before Champaign County Judge Adam Dill in connection with the June 8, 2017 death of Caitlin Connor, 10. I believe it is within the court's authority to approve or disapprove electronic home detention in this case, said Dill, who continued the hearing to August 24th, so that Cruz's attorney, Matt Lee, could present evidence to persuade the judge why his client should get home detention. Matt Connor, the father of Caitlin Connor, let the judge know in an eloquently worded victim impact statement that took him 15 minutes to read that the family strongly objects to Cruz serving his sentence at home. I think it's a joke. It's insulting to us, the family, our friends, the community, he said, after the hearing of the potential for Cruz to enjoy his television, his bed, and his family during the sentence. I think he needs to endure more than he has. Also injured in the crash on Interstate 57 near I-74 that afternoon were Connor's other daughter, Lily Lawrence, 14, and his mother, Deborah Connor, 59, of Mattoon. Cruz admitted that he was traveling south in his Jeep when his cell phone dinged and he went to retrieve it to open it. When he looked up, he could not stop in time to avoid running into the back of Deborah Connor's Chevrolet Cobalt, crushing the rear of it and forcing it into a semi-trailer tractor truck in front of it. They were stopped in traffic in a construction zone. Caitlin was in the back seat. Lily was in the front with her grandmother, who was driving. Lee said the home confinement sentence would allow his client to continue to work so he can support his family. While acknowledging the horrific loss that the Connors have suffered, Lee said his client also feels the pain of his actions daily. That loss will be felt by them every day the rest of their life. It's a horrible tragedy and a mistake, selfish in some sense. But it wasn't an evil thing. Probably 90% of people in this country have done it in their lives, Lee said. Stephen Cruz is the last guy who's ever going to text while driving again, said Lee, expressing concern that Cruz might lose his job if he has to serve 6 months behind bars. Assistant State's Attorney Victoria Dedman said the state had no position on whether Cruz served the sentence in jail or on home detention. She said it's up to the sheriff to decide how such sentences are carried out. Dill responded that he felt he had the final authority on that question, even though Cruz was found eligible for the program. Cruz was also ordered to pay fines, fees, and costs in the neighborhood of $1,100. Dedman said Cruz was convicted in 2010 in Effingham County of driving under the influence, but successfully completed a period of court supervision. In return for Cruz's plea, the state dismissed other charges of reckless homicide as to Caitlin and aggravated reckless driving and aggravated unlawful use of an electronic communication device pertaining to her grandmother and sister. Deborah Connor sustained multiple fractures as well as a head injury that continues to plague her ability to think clearly and communicate. Lily Lawrence, Caitlin's sister, sustained a broken leg. Cruz is the first person in Champaign County to be convicted of the charge of distracted driving that leads to a death. It became law in July 2014 and carries a maximum period of probation of 30 months and a potential prison term of between 1 and 3 years. State's Attorney Julia Reitz called the law untested, particularly when it comes to the definition of use of the electronic communication device. Our goal was to provide certainty to the Connor family and give them the opportunity to make their statement to the court and to the public to have Mr. Cruz take responsibility for Caitlin's entirely preventable tragic death and to provide an avenue to educate the public on the very real danger created by distracted driving, particularly when the distraction is caused by electronic communication devices. And in the same section, victim's father, it slaps me in the face. He wants worse punishments for distracted driving, by Mary Shank, Urbana. Matt Connor said he's not there yet when it comes to forgiving the man whose seconds of inattention while driving changed the Connor family's lives forever. I struggle with it. I go back and forth, said the Camargo man, whose 10-year-old daddy's girl was killed more than a year ago in a traffic crash caused by a man who turned his attention from the road to a dinging cell phone. Connor's other daughter and his mother were severely injured in the same crash on Interstate 57 near Champaign on June 8, 2017. Stephen Cruz of Mattoon pleaded guilty Thursday to aggravated unlawful use of an electronic communication device, admitting that was the cause of Caitlin Connor's death. In 2014, the Illinois legislature made the offense a felony, albeit the lowest level felony, carrying a maximum sentence of 1 to 3 years in prison. I see it every day, Connor said of drivers who ignore Illinois law regarding the use of cell phones by those behind the wheel. It slaps me in the face, the serious problem we have with phones and distracted driving. It really impacts me a lot. Connor made his remarks outside the Champaign County Courthouse, where Cruz, also a father, had pleaded guilty. He called for tougher laws for the offense, but said that, unlike the length of time it took this country to treat drunken drivers more seriously, it shouldn't take as long to deal with drivers distracted by cell phones. It's a process, he said, of the campaign dubbed Caitlin's Challenge, to get drivers not to look at cell phones at all when they are behind the wheel. You can't change people's minds overnight. No matter how heartbreaking of a story you tell, it's not going to happen overnight, he said. Minutes earlier, Connor was inside the crowded courtroom, reading in a surprisingly steady voice a 15-minute statement describing his and the rest of his immediate family's lives in the wake of the crash. His 4-year-old son wonders where his sister is and struggles with understanding death. He tends to think that anyone he hasn't seen in a while is dead. His daughter, Lily, in addition to enduring a rod in her broken leg, suffers from the guilt of surviving and the memories of the crash itself. His mother, Deborah Connor, spent weeks in the hospital with broken vertebrae in her neck and back, broken ribs, a shattered shoulder she still cannot use, and bleeding in her brain that continues to vex her daily activities. His wife, Amanda, was demoted in her job because of all the work she missed. He also lost many hours of pay from missed work and had to help his mother financially, he said. Husband and wife both suffer from anxiety and depression. And Connor said he is filled with anger toward Cruz, and from what I see every day on my hour round trip commute, it's always more cars than I can count racing past me, staring at their phones. He called for tougher, more specific laws, at least on par with the penalties faced by drunken drivers who kill. For some reason, it's become my responsibility, on top of everything else I've been through, to show that people who make the same choice as Mr. Cruz are making, the same type of choice as the guy who drank too much and drove, Connor said. Not to bring more shame to those who are guilty of this, but to get people to stop doing it and to save more people from going through what we have endured, he said. And now in the From Our Readers section, there's a piece by David Green from Champaign called Young People See Future in New Light. The performances of Bernie Sanders in 2016 and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently continue a rich 200-year-old discussion regarding social democratic and socialist agendas. However, these modest events arouse consternation and condensation from George Will and letter writer Dan Metz. Young people with sensible quasi-socialist ideas, for example, government in a rich and supposedly democratic society, can and should provide a basic standard of living, health care, and education for all citizens, need to be straight. What about the Soviet Union? Coherence is in short supply. Metz asks, In a country where individualism is valued and freedom is a tradition, who could embrace a guaranteed government income for every person, universal government health care, and the rest of the depressing, failed socialist liberal platform? Who indeed? Leave aside the contradictions of individualism and freedom in relation to the American historical propensity for indigenous genocide, slavery, discrimination, mass incarceration, violent repression of labor unions, and global dominance by subversion and violence. 1 million killed in Iraq for a lie? Oops, we're good. Capitalism necessarily exploits the working class to the level of destitution, the environment to the level of destruction. It promotes radical inequality, endemic financial crisis, and chronic global conflagrations based on its relentless need for increased profits, cheap labor and resources, and infinite compound growth. It flirts with nuclear war and catastrophic climate change, meanwhile making a mockery of democracy. Thus, many young people see their political future in the broad context of class struggles for social and environmental justice. Go figure. And that again was written by David Green of Champaign. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, July 27th, 2018 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.